Iran says a joint statement by members of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council is part of a failed policy aimed at promoting Iranophobia. Ukraine says it will continue to export grain from the southern port city of Odessa despite recent Russian attacks targeting local energy infrastructure. In Peru, supporters of ousted President Pedro Castillo demand his release and the closure of Congress. At this, as the new leader is swearing in her cabinet. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The top story, Iran condemning unfounded allegations raised in a joint statement by members of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says the statement is nothing but a rehash of failed policies to promote Iranophobia. He says such actions are a futile attempt to cover up tension-provoking moves by certain GCC states offering financial, political, and logistical support to terrorist groups. According to the spokesman, the destructive policies of certain member states have inflicted massive human and financial losses on the region. Kanani urged the GCC states to revisit their approach to regional issues and take a constructive path. In a statement issued at the end of their 43rd summit, GCC member states again accused Iran of continuing to support terrorist groups and militia in Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen. Writer and political columnist Saeed Shahabi explains how the GCC implements the U.S. and Israeli policies in the region.
The GCC have always adopted what the United States and its allies want, and now that it has allied, they have the GCC countries, most, many of them, with half of them, have adopted a new policy of aligning with the Israelis. Then, of course, Iran will always become the target. Now, as far as supporting terrorist groups, it is a well-known fact that the Iraqis and the Syrians, and of course, even the Yemenis and Egyptians, have paid dearly for what the terrorists have done. And now these terrorist groups are known to have been supported by petrodollars from the GCC countries. So, all in all, it is clear also, even to the West, that without Iran's targeting of ISIS in Syria and Iraq, probably ISIS threats would and acts would have reached the Western capitals by now.
Chinese President Xi Jinping has ended his three-day visit to Saudi Arabia. There, he signed a series of agreements with Saudi officials, boosting ties with the Arab Kingdom. And that at a time of Saudi Arabia's increasingly shaky relationship with the United States.
President Xi hails a new era of relationships with the Persian Gulf state during his meeting with King Salman and his three-day stay at Yamama Palace in Saudi Arabia. The world's largest exporter of crude oil, joined by the world's largest importer of it, signed a comprehensive strategic partnership agreement that involved the Chinese tech giant Huawei. Huawei is one of the companies that just recently was barred from exporting its equipment to the U.S. because of a recent imports ban in the U.S. on certain high-profile Chinese tech firms, including the likes of ZTE and Hikvision. While this was the most restrictive ban, it is not an isolated ruling. Anti-Chinese rhetoric became mainstream during Donald Trump's presidency when he banned all of Huawei's 5G equipment from the U.S. and even by extension in some EU countries. He also banned U.S. citizens from owning Xiaomi stocks, labeling the company as a communist Chinese military company. Despite the U.S. security officials warning that equipment from Chinese brands such as Huawei in the field of telecommunications can be used to collect sensitive information, most of the 5G infrastructure in the Persian Gulf states is built, at least with the partial assistance from Huawei. With all the hassle that the U.S. has been causing these Chinese businesses, it was only a matter of time before they looked elsewhere to grow their business, as relationships between the U.S. and China are shaky at best. Now Saudi Arabia has become an important destination to grow these brands, but on the other side, Saudi Arabia's relationships with the U.S. is also at a low point, and King Salman's meeting with Xi Jinping solidifies the signal that was already being sent that Saudi Arabia is inching away from the U.S. This is becoming more and more apparent over the disagreements between the two countries over energy policies, security guarantees, and human rights issues. The U.S. isn't making inflammatory comments about the visit, but the coordinator for strategic communications of U.S. National Security Council, John Kirby, did say that, quote, "we're mindful of the influence that China is trying to grow around the world."
The Chinese president and Saudi rulers have announced economic partnership deals worth $30 billion. A more important announcement was also made by the Chinese president, who is calling for oil trade in his country's currency, yuan, and that would pose a direct threat to the petro-based dollar system and the dollar itself.
Saudi Arabia's energy minister said that the relationship between the two countries is witnessing an epoch-making milestone, as he vowed that the kingdom will remain China's credible and reliable partner when it comes to oil production. Saudi Arabia isn't the only country warming up to China, and even Russia, as the OPEC Plus decision to cut down on oil production amid rising demands from the West, and especially the U.S., was a joint decision between the kingdom and Russia as the leaders of the major oil exporting organization. While Saudi Arabia sees the U.S. as its top security partner, the recent shakeup in their relationships, especially as a result of that very same OPEC Plus decision, has prompted the oil-rich kingdom to diversify on its partners list. It has shown that it does not want to hurt its relationship with Russia, as they have significant shared interests as leaders of the most influential crude oil exporting organization, and now it is showing that it is not shying away from cozying up to the US's trade war rival, China. As the use of Chinese yuan in the China-Saudi oil settlements is becoming increasingly more likely, especially during President Xi's visit to the kingdom, there is also the possibility of Saudi Arabia joining BRICS, as interest has been shown by the kingdom to join the trade-centered organization that also includes Russia as a member state. If, in fact, Saudi Arabia agrees to receive the Chinese yuan in exchange for its oil, that will be considered a massive blow to the falling hegemony of the U.S. dollar in world trade, and especially in oil. This de-dollarization effort has been accelerating, and the first major instance of it happened as Western sanctions first started pouring in on Russia to limit its trade potential. What ended up happening was that as China's oil imports from Russia went up, state-owned oil enterprises increasingly used the Chinese yuan as payments. While all European Union member states are one way or another forced to cooperate with the U.S. in sanctioning Russia, even if at an extremely high cost, the rest of the world is seeing less and less of an obligation to bend down to the will of the once hegemonic superpower, as they see the prospect of a multipolar world more and more plausible and desirable.
Ukraine will continue to export grain from the southern port city of Odessa, despite recent Russian attacks targeting local energy infrastructure. According to the Agriculture Ministry, traders are facing problems, but for now there is no talk of suspending shipments. President Zelensky says that the latest round of Russian strikes have left more than 1.5 million people without power in the Odessa region. Ukraine is one of the largest grain exporters in the world. It resumed shipments in July after a six-month halt caused by the war. But there have been some disruptions, partially due to Russian strikes on energy networks since October. Now, Moscow saying that the strikes are in response to Ukrainian attacks on Russian power lines. News Review Time. A probe into corruption allegations involving an EU lawmaker is sending shockwaves through the European Parliament, prompting strong reactions from officials in the bloc. European Parliament Vice President Eva Kaili and four others have been arrested in connection with a corruption probe into money payments by Persian Gulf country to influence the decisions of MEPs. Prosecutors have not named the country under investigation, but a legal source close to the case says it was Qatar. Now, according to prosecutors, the state is suspected of influencing the decisions of the European Parliament through cash payments or gifts to top figures. Qatar is saying it's not aware of any details of the investigation, stressing any claim of misconduct by Doha are gravely misinformed. Time now to get some information insight on this. So joining me will be our own correspondent in Brussels, Jerome Hughes. Also with me is John Bosnich. He's a journalist, activist, and political analyst in Belgrade. Now, Jerome, what's the story? And tell us about what the atmosphere is like in the EU Parliament regarding this.
Well, Behrouz, I think, you know, everybody's just looking for Monday to come along, because I think then we will get more information and a lot more reaction as well from the European Union when sort of ordinary business resumes. Because a lot of this sort of, we got information late on Friday. And it's extremely embarrassing, there's no doubt of that, not just for the European Parliament, which has 705 legislators from across the 27 country EU, but it's embarrassing for EU as a whole. And it shines a light and asks questions about the EU's ethics in general. And it's very interesting when you have organizations like Transparency International saying that this is not an isolated incident. And in fact, when we have covered or when we have compiled stories in the past from Brussels in relation to corruption, we've interviewed former staff members inside the European Parliament who have said that corruption is rife. But really, when you see it there written down in black and white, the scale of this and the potential much larger scale, as I say, I think in the coming days we're going to get a lot more information. Well, then it is shocking. But what we do know is that police here, in terms of the prosecutor's office, they were involved for months now in an investigation, and it primarily focused on MEPs, their parliamentary assistants. So, you know, technically they're allowed to have three accredited assistants inside their offices here in Brussels, and then they would normally have assistants back in their constituencies. And when we talk about parliamentary assistants, you know, these are people that would answer emails, that they would organize speeches for MEPs, they would respond to media queries, this type of thing. They would do, you know, generally more or less everything, go and make a cup of coffee, etc. And but they would also interact with other political groupings within in the parliament and so on. The focus of the investigation, we understand, was in relation to parliamentary assistants and their activities and their you know, alleged illegal activities. But then it has sort of, it has scoped out to include some of these big names like Eva Kaili. She's from Greece, she's a former television presenter, and she's under investigation. She was arrested. There was another name mentioned, a former MEP, Pierre Antonio Panzeri, and people associated with him. Apparently there was one parliamentary assistant who was arrested as well. And we're talking about raids on Friday inside 16 homes here in Brussels, and €600,000 was recovered by police, and also computer equipment and that type of thing. So actually what we're hearing is that we could be expecting more arrests in the coming days. And actually, as I say, more reaction tomorrow, because the president of the European Parliament, I mean, Eva Kaili, she's just one of 14 vice presidents of the parliament, but obviously there's only one president, and that is Roberta Metsola. And actually the plenary session of the parliament is due to kick off tomorrow, Monday. And so there's an opening, there's a, you know, start of business statement by the president. So we're expecting, there's no way really she could not mention this tomorrow when she starts talking. And we're also likely to get more reaction from the European Commission, which is the executive arm of the EU. You know, here we have many different institutions associated with the EU, but this is the legislative wing, the diplomatic wing of the EU, and they're always doing debates about ethics and about human rights on a weekly basis they are having debates when they're talking about corruption in terms of outside the EU and so on, but now this seems to go to the heart of the institution itself.
Okay. We'll also definitely follow that up tomorrow when things are happening. Okay, Jerome, thank you so much for that explanation. Already you explained a lot. Now, John, I want to ask you about what also Jerome rightly called EU's ethics issue and corruption that's reportedly being reported as being rampant.
Well, we have to start from the top. You might recall the remarks of Nigel Farage, who was leading the British withdrawal from the EU. He referred to the EU as one of the most corrupt institutions in human history. And this is something that he said widely across England and Scotland, and spoke to the people of England and convinced them to leave the European Union. Here in Serbia, it's well known that the European Union structures are corrupt and that many officials are available for receiving bribes. It's just an open secret. It was only a matter of time until somebody would be arrested. And fittingly enough, these arrests were conducted on International Anti-Corruption Day. So what we're seeing here is just an arrest that follows a pattern of years and years of corruption at the highest levels in the EU.
Yeah, that's really funny. It reminds me of the words of the EU official who said, the other parts of the world are jungle and we are what the world should be. Okay, thank you so much for that. Jerome Hughes in Brussels, John Bosnich in Belgrade. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Role of Erdogan power's policies in recent bitter events in Iran is obvious. This is the part of speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. This ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Officer and Police Training. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, praise be to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and blessings be upon our Master, Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and upon his pure progeny, particularly the remaining vestige of God on earth. I am very happy and thankful to God that after a relatively long break, I have the honor to see you young graduates again in a face-to-face meeting on this day this year. It is good to hear that several thousand young people have joined the armed forces, and this happens every year, whether it is young university graduates who have earned the rank of officer and enter the workforce, and those who enter the university receive a shoulder mark and a study. Both of them inject a new spirit into the armed forces in a certain way. Both of these groups of young people being a message of renewal and stability.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Whenever young people enter a place, whenever they join an association or an organization, they actually bring the message of strength and renewal to that place. The presence of the Iranian youth in all fields is promising. So whenever they enter various fields, such as the scientific, economic, political, organizational, and military sectors, they bring with them the positive message of hope, renewal and innovation. Today there is a misleading propaganda campaign going on that tries to show the opposite of this. The aim of this propaganda is to imply that the Iranian youth have lost their values, have no hope for the future, and do not feel they have any sort of responsibility. There is a propaganda campaign that is seriously pursuing this goal. But the reality of this matter is the opposite of this. What is happening in our country is the exact opposite. Our younger generation has progressed brilliantly in all fields and arenas up until today.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A group of Australian lawmakers arrived in Taiwan despite warnings from Beijing over the visit at a time of rising tensions over the self-ruled island.
There's a group of bipartisan members of the parliament from Australia currently visiting Taiwan. They are already here. We appreciate that the Australian parliament is very friendly to Taiwan.
Taipei's foreign ministry stated that the members of the delegation will meet the territory's president and other officials during their five-day visit. The ministry added the meetings will focus on a wide array of issues of mutual interest. The Chinese foreign ministry expressed opposition to the trip, calling on Canberra to respect the One China principle.
Taiwan is an inalienable part of Chinese territory. The One China policy is a recognized norm of international relations, and it is also the prerequisite and political basis for China to develop friendly relations with other countries. The Australian side should earnestly abide by the One China policy, stop any form of official exchanges with the Taiwan region.
Under the One China policy, Beijing considers Taiwan a breakaway province that should be reunited with the mainland. The spokesperson also warned Australia against official exchanges with Taiwan, calling on Canberra to stop sending wrong signals to separatist forces in Taiwan. The visit to Taiwan comes as Australia's recently elected Labour government has moved to repair its strained diplomatic relations with China. Last month, Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese met China's President Xi Jinping at the G20 summit in Bali, Indonesia. But the parliamentary trip to Taiwan would cast a shadow on attempts to build ties between Beijing and Canberra. Albanese sought to play down the mission's significance after it was first reported. He insisted the visit was separate from government business, saying there have been backbench visits to Taiwan for a long time. Australia had long maintained it didn't have to choose between China and the US, but in recent years, its attitude toward Beijing has revealed where it stands in the world. Signing the AUKUS security pact with the US and UK, and rotational presence of American forces in Australia are a testament to Canberra taking the side of the US over China. The Pentagon has announced that the United States will increase the rotational presence of its forces in Australia.
Today we agreed to deepen our defense cooperation in several important ways, including enhancing our force posture cooperation. And based upon today's talks, we will increase rotational presence of U.S. forces in Australia. That includes rotations of bomber task forces, fighters, and future rotations of U.S. Navy and U.S. Army capabilities.
The United States and Australia agreed to deepen their military ties, citing shared concerns over China's actions around Taiwan.
What we want is a region that is stable, prosperous, and respectful of sovereignty. And as we've made clear many times, U.S. engagement in the Indo-Pacific makes an indispensable contribution to such a region.
The two allies made the announcement following annual high-level talks between the top U.S. and Australian defense and diplomatic officials. The two countries have also agreed to invite Japan to boost its military cooperation. Washington sees Canberra as a vital partner in its effort to push back against China in the Indo-Pacific, and analysts say Australia could have a crucial logistical role to play in the defense of Taiwan against any move by Beijing. Australia's Northern Territory is already host to frequent military collaborations with the United States. Thousands of U.S. Marines rotate through the territory annually for training and joint exercises, started under former President Barack Obama. The United States is also planning to deploy up to 6 nuclear-capable B-52 bombers to an airbase in northern Australia, amid heightened tensions with China. Canberra has moved to bolster relations in the Pacific amid growing Chinese influence, including a security pact between China and Solomon Islands in April. In September, the United States, United Kingdom, and Australia marked the one-year anniversary of the AUKUS security pact. They then announced that they have made significant progress towards Australia acquiring nuclear-powered submarines.
Israeli forces have shot dead 3 Palestinians during a raid on the Jenin refugee camp in northern West Bank. According to eyewitness accounts, a large number of Israeli military forces stormed the camp on Thursday morning. The attack triggered violent confrontations with local residents, during which Palestinians were killed. The victims were identified by Palestinian media as Tariq al-Damj, Siddiqui Zakarne, and Atta Shibli. According to reports, before the confrontation broke out, Israeli snipers were positioned on the rooftops of buildings overlooking the camp. At least 10 people have also been injured there. Israeli forces also fired directly at an ambulance during the raid, and its medical staff reportedly survived death. Israeli forces have recently been conducting overnight raids and killings in the northern occupied West Bank, mainly in the cities of Jenin and Nablus. New groups of Palestinian resistance fighters have been formed there. The latest figures bring up the number of Palestinians killed by the Israeli forces since the beginning of the year to 216. At least 164 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank. Scores of Palestinians have also been killed in Israeli raids in the Gaza Strip.
Simply saying this, Israeli establishment, the military, the security apparatus, and the settlers have clear orders to kill. They kill Palestinians even in cases of suspicions. They are always quick to pull the trigger. Recently, almost all raids to the West Bank areas leave Palestinians either killed or injured, and none of the soldiers have been investigated to any of the crimes.
According to the United Nations, The number of Palestinians killed by Israel in the occupied West Bank this year is the highest in 16 years. Rights organizations say that Israel is conducting a shoot-to-kill policy against Palestinians.
Their main program is ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. And the second is to suppress any form of resistance of Palestinian people and to enhance settlements everywhere. So practically, Israel has all the interest in enhancing the oppression against Palestinians. And we've seen even certain escalation during election time because Israeli parties were using Palestinian blood to feed their election purposes.
The rising violence against Palestinians comes against the backdrop of Israel's defiance to be held accountable for its crimes. The Qatar state-funded broadcaster Al Jazeera has filed a lawsuit at the International Criminal Court, the ICC, over the killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Al Jazeera says it has new evidence showing that she was killed by Israeli forces.
Many have called for an investigation. Shireen's family, who are here today, have made their own request. The Palestinian Authority has provided a comprehensive body of evidence, and yet there's been complete silence from the Office of the Prosecutor on this case, on cases across the board, in fact, in the Palestine situation.
The veteran journalist was shot in the head, killed on May 11 while she was covering their raid in the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. At the time of her killing, the 51-year-old journalist was wearing easily recognizable press attire. Al Jazeera now says its legal team has conducted a full and detailed investigation into the case and has unearthed new evidence based on several eyewitness accounts and video footage that clearly shows that Abu Akleh and her colleagues were directly fired in a deliberate killing by Israeli forces.
While there is overwhelming evidence from multiple eyewitnesses, over a dozen of investigations by reputable news outlets and human rights organizations and the United Nations, that Shireen was targeted and killed by an Israeli soldier, my family still doesn't know who the person is that shot that deadly bullet and who was involved in the chain of command that allowed them to kill my aunt.
It says the claim by Israeli authorities that the Palestinian journalist was killed by mistake in an exchange of fire is, quote, completely unfounded. Multiple investigations by independent organizations and media outlets have already concluded that Abu Akleh was deliberately shot by Israeli forces.
This was a proposal that was floated with only in recent hours, only today, by Al Jazeera. So I don't know that it has been a topic of discussion. I don't know that it would be a topic of discussion unless we had representations from the ICC that they were going to take an opinion one way or another.
Well, I mean, she was an American citizen.
Of course.
So it's not like you have no interest in it
at all.
But you oppose it.
We oppose it in this case for the reasons that we've
The Israeli military, following a long denial, finally admitted in September that Abu Akleh might have accidentally been killed by Israeli fire directed towards suspects identified as armed Palestinian gunmen. The United States has said it's investigating the case, but has refused to publicly condemn Israel for the killing.
Tehran has slammed Washington's move to push a draft resolution aimed to remove Iran from the UN's Commission on the Status of Women. Iran's foreign ministry says any misuse of the internal developments in Iran to exert political pressure on the country is condemned and unacceptable. Iran has just started a four-year term on the body after a recent voting session by the UN Economic and Social Council. Tehran has repeatedly warned that some Western countries are exploiting human rights for their own political ends. In recent weeks, rioters went on the rampage across the country, brutally attacking security officers and causing massive damage to public property as Western powers, especially the United States, provided support. The European Union and some Western countries have imposed sanctions on Iran over its approach toward the riots. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said that the U.S. and certain European countries are behind the political and illegal draft resolution and that they are seeking to exert pressure on independent countries to pass it. He said the U.S. move is an action against the free vote of countries in international organizations and structures and questions the legality of such mechanisms in international bodies. He added, There are member countries of the UN Security Council or the Human Rights Council and Human Rights Assemblies that committed countless crimes against governments and independent nations throughout their history and now use human rights tools to exert pressure. Iran has lashed out at Western officials for cheering rioters in independent states while suppressing peaceful protesters in their own countries. Iran's foreign ministry says countries that have coups, conspiracies, interventions, and devastating wars with millions of deaths in their history are now pretending to be defenders of human rights in other countries. The best example would be Western countries' hypocritical behavior vis-a-vis protests in Iran and their own states. Western officials say the protests in Britain, Germany, France, Canada, and Australia are bad and deserve severe confrontation, but riots in their targeted countries are good and deserve support. The riots in Iran began after the death of a young woman named Mahsa Amini in September. She collapsed at a police station in Tehran and later died at a hospital. Since then, the issue of women's rights suddenly caught the imagination of the world. The self-proclaimed human rights champions in the West who turn a blind eye to gross human rights abuses in the US and Europe are accusing Iranian authorities of killing the woman, even though all evidence, including the forensic report, scoffs at those claims. The Islamic Republic has strongly censured several countries for provoking riots in the country through their spy agencies and propaganda apparatus. London, in particular, hosts several anti-Iranian networks, including Iran International, Manoto, and BBC Persian. The U.S. is pushing for the removal of Iran from the UN Commission on the Status of Women following trumped-up claims by foreign media that attributed the killing of women to the Iranian government during the recent unrest in the country. They claim that they are acting in defense of women's rights, but they are in fact violating those rights and preventing women from raising their issues through pushing for the removal of Iran from the UN Commission. The 54-member UN Economic and Social Council is expected to vote on December 14th whether to oust Iran from the commission or not. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin has said the country is building a more lethal force posture in the Indo-Pacific as part of efforts to make sure China doesn't dominate the region the way it intends to. Addressing the Reagan National Defense Forum, Austin said China is the only country with both the will and increasingly the power to reshape its region and the international order. He added that Washington will not let that happen. The Pentagon chief added that the next few years will set the terms of the U.S. competition with the People's Republic of China, saying Beijing will shape the future of security in Europe. Referring to the modernization of the country's military force, he said that the U.S. is aligning its budget as never before to China challenge.
We're aligning our budget as never before to the China challenge. We're making the department's largest investment ever in R&D. And forging stronger capabilities. And we're modernizing training and equipping the U.S. military contingencies in the Indo-Pacific.
He went on to say one of the meanings of deterrence is sea power, announcing that the Pentagon is investing in the new construction of 9 battle force ships and Columbia-class ballistic missile submarines. Last month, one of Washington's fourth-class nuclear-powered carriers made its first transit to Europe. Austin also noted that the Pentagon is concerned about Russia and remains committed to arming Ukraine while avoiding escalating that conflict into a U.S. war with Moscow. However, he said between the two nuclear power threats, China remains the greater risk. The Pentagon has also unveiled B-21 Raider, its first new strategic bomber in more than 30 years.
The B-21 Raider is the first strategic bomber in more than 3 decades. It is a testament to America's enduring advantages in ingenuity and innovation, and it's proof of the department's long-term commitment to building advanced capabilities that will fortify America's ability to deter aggression today and into the future.
The nuclear-capable Batwing plane is being designed to best the quickly growing cyber, space, and nuclear capabilities of Beijing. The bomber is part of a major nuclear triad overhaul underway that the Congressional Budget Office has estimated will cost $1.2 trillion through 2046. It includes the radar serving as the backbone of the future airleg of the Triad, but it also requires modernizing the nation's Silo-launched nuclear intercontinental ballistic missiles and its nuclear submarine fleet. The comments by Austin amount to a new warning shot to President Xi Jinping, even as the U.S. looks to establish what it calls guardrails and keep tension with China from spiraling out of control. The Pentagon released its annual report last week on China, which said the Asian nation has doubled its number of nuclear warheads in a fraction of time the U.S. expected it to. China could have roughly 1,500 nuclear warheads by 2038, which are far less than what the United States possesses right now. The U.S. maintained 5,550 nuclear warheads as of December 1st of this year. But U.S. military officials keep claiming that China will soon surpass Russia as the top nuclear threat to the United States, warning that the two nuclear powers have no mechanisms to avoid miscommunication. China has reportedly accelerated the expansion of its nuclear arsenal due to a change in the country's assessment of the threat posed by the U.S. The U.S. Defense Department has the largest discretionary budget of all the federal agencies, and it may receive up to $847 billion in the 2023 budget if Congress passes the current funding bill before this legislative session ends. In a recent meeting with its Chinese counterpart, Austin said he made it clear that the United States will continue to fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows. On the other hand, China's defense minister said Taiwan is at the center of the country's core interests and is a red line the U.S. should not cross. He added that the issue has nothing to do with external forces and is for Chinese people to decide. Washington and Beijing have held war games and traded jabs since a visit to Taiwan by the U.S. House Speaker in August. China claims Taiwan as part of its territory. It has harshly criticized Washington's ties with Taipei as interference in its internal affairs. The two Western and Eastern powerhouses currently disagree on just about every major issue, from human rights, Taiwan, the Ukraine war, North Korea, and the transfer of technology to the shape and naming of the map.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
به
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of For a Better Life. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Asma. Once more, I have the honor and the pleasure of being here with you all. Just like what usually happens in here, we will have some precious moments thinking about things that matter the most to get into a better life. Just a quick reminder, I'm not going to teach you anything. Neither I have the intention to do so. It's just a student of literature who is sharing her ideas with her friends from all around the world. And such a privilege it is for me to be the speaker, of course. Let me start today's episode with some personal story. Years ago when I graduated and got my BA on my hand, I had too much passion for teaching. And that's a common thing among all the students who study different languages. The first interview I had was more of a lesson than anything else for me. The manager asked me a few questions and everything went well, except the part when he asked me if I had any experience in teaching. Then just as I said no, I saw an awful sign of frustration in his eyes, which told me the whole story of me being dumped as a result. Now, just in my way at that institute, I learned two very sad things about the way with human beings, about the ways of life and about the way human psyche works. The first thing is that they lie when they say honesty is the best policy, and they appreciate lies more than anything else. Second, they all judge you with their own prejudices. The predetermined things would define you more than your true features. Now, I'm sure similar occasions had happened to you, all of you, and you've got dumped before and without being even given a single chance. Now, what was your reaction? Why is it that way? I know the answer to that, but let's go for a short break and then we'll be back. Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to For a Better Life. And in here, we're talking about something that is pretty much common and it happens to all of us. And I cannot claim that I myself do not have any prejudices about anyone or anything in this world, because then that's going to be a big lie. I don't know how that happens, but according to the place we live in, according to the kind of people we are surrounded with, according to the kind of schooling we get, according to the sort of books we read, according to the kind of media we peek, and whatever, according to everything that we are surrounded with, there comes a special notions and thinking in our brain that are called prejudices. And as I just told you about my personal experience, it happens many times in our life. I told you, we all have suffered from it. The reactions of different people are different. I learned two very sad things. Maybe what I just told you is a little bit of harsh, but then honestly, that was my first impression after I got out of that institute. And I guess it happens, the same thing happens with every single one in my place. You know, usually people are just like this. They tell you that they favor honesty, but when you tell them the truth, they do not tolerate it. People usually say that they do not judge others, but unfortunately what happens is that we all judge each other, and there is no way to say that I am not a person who is judgmental. No, I guess it's pretty natural somehow, let's say, though it's very much sad and very much heartbreaking. But then it's the truth again. Well, the question is, now that I don't like someone to judge me based on a predetermined thing that I don't know from where it had come, what happens that these ideas start to grow, we talked about, and why it happens We also said that the reasons are the place we have been born in. I don't know, the people we have been surrounded with. All of these things and matters are going to affect how we think. And these things that we think about are going to make our ideas. And then little by little, they're going to turn into our prejudices. Unfortunately, the result is going to be so maddening because sometimes you judge someone in a wrong way that is going to destroy their future. The thing which is very much important about prejudice is that sometimes you do not know and you're unaware of the amount of sadness you're imposing to other people's life, the amount of destruction you're causing to happen in their lives. I know, because as I just told you, every single one of us is prone to these prejudices, and it's pretty much natural because that's how our brain works and how we help it grow like this. But the truth is that we should be pretty much careful about every single decision we make based on our notions. Sometimes it's a good way to get out of these notions, out of these prejudices, to think like you have no predetermined thoughts about anything. Like, for example, I actually have practiced that. Even when with my friends, even when I come to have some problems with them, after we talk about the situation and after the situation is clarified already, I try to think like it's a clean slate and there's nothing that I know about them. I give them a chance to prove themselves. And if anything happens again, then I would say, yes, I was right. You know what I mean? I mean, at least give people a chance to prove themselves. And then if it is right or if it is wrong, then you're free to make your decisions. But the important thing is just this fact that you should not take the chances from the people, especially those people to whom your decision is going to make a lot of difference. So whenever you're put in a situation when you have the power to have an effect on someone's life, try to put your prejudices aside. If I tell you that, okay, try to at least give other people a chance to prove the otherwise, is going to be a more logical method to fight prejudices.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
There are pretty much of stories, pretty much of novels, movies, whatever we see around us and we read, even the stories in newspaper, then you see that a single person has turned into a criminal just because of a prejudiced person who has judged him wrongly, just because of a predetermined thought that someone else had about someone, then their life is turning upside down. So all I mean to say is that there are some simple things in our life that we might not be aware of the amount of their importance, but they are important to other people. I would want to say prejudice is everywhere, and there is no way for us to claim that we're not a member of these people who have predetermined notions and thoughts about others and about every single thing in this world. No one can claim that way, but we at least can claim that we give people a chance. We give things a chance to prove the otherwise. And we're not like those sort of people who blindly believe in one thing and then they go accordingly. No, everything in this world has an opportunity to change. So we have to act accordingly. That's it. And in the end, I should say that we use that proverb too much, that do not judge a book by its cover, but we usually do it in our life. Then just try to think and remember if it ever happened to you to judge someone wrongly and unfairly and then not doing anything about it, though it had had some very bad effects on those people. So thank you. Until another session, I bid you farewell. May Allah protect you with His never-sleeping eyes. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share. Assalamu alaikum and peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the new show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week we'll be looking at a trending story from the news world which has a direct relevance to the religion of Islam, and we'll break it down from a Muslim perspective. Today we'll be focusing on the World Cup football tournament, which for the first time ever is being hosted by a Muslim-majority Arab country in the Middle East, and whether or not the Qatari authorities have done enough to safeguard Islamic values amid the avalanche of non-Muslim guests and Western pressure.
Has Qatar compromised Islamic principles to host the 2022 World Cup? Amid an intense pressure campaign from European nations to change local laws, some Muslim onlookers fear Doha may have compromised too much to cater for their non-Muslim guests. Qatar has been condemned by the West over Sharia-inspired laws, which ban alcohol consumption, public displays of affection, same-sex relationships, and immodest dress codes. However, Doha has made exemptions on some of these rules for visiting spectators, including fan zones which allow alcohol sales, creating a debate between fans.
Alcohol, I think, is sold in many other places. But it's forbidden to drink alcohol in the street or in the stadiums or other public places. So I'm supporting to respect the Islamic rules or the Islamic countries or the Islamic conditions.
If that's the case, I don't think that should be. I don't think that should be the decision that they should make, especially when they did have plans for international beverages, different tents set up.
I don't want to, I'll be the last person you ask this question. I wouldn't want to see that lifestyle compromised. I wouldn't want, with my kids and my family enjoying my time out and being confronted by a drunken society. I wouldn't say hooligan, but drunken and disorderly fans.
Criticism of the World Cup's first ever Arab host, Qatar, was always expected, but few would have predicted the outpouring of anti-Islam sentiment that accompanied it. Qatari authorities have made efforts to showcase Islam during the event also. Quran recitations, pauses for prayer, and inviting famous dawah activists. But does the dawah effort make up for the permitting of haram practices?
Well, joining us in the studio today to talk more about Islam and the Qatar-hosted World Cup is Sheikh Tawqir Ishaq, an international lecturer in Islamic sciences, currently the head of halal certification for the Halal Regulatory Commission, and Roja Mohammed Saleh, a journalist with a specialism in Islamic affairs. He's also the editor-in-chief of Muslim news website Five Pillars. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on, of course. Assalamu alaikum to you both. Sheikh, let me come straight to you for your expertise on this. I'm very interested to hear what your opinion is on Qatar. Straight up, do you think Qatar has compromised on Islamic values here?
Of course Qatar has compromised Islamic values, but that's not to be unexpected. Why are we so surprised about that? Just because you're a Muslim majority country doesn't mean you're an Islamic country. You've got a half a dozen countries run by monarchies. They will interpret Islam how they like. They will implement the laws they like. We shouldn't be so surprised. We shouldn't have expectations from them. If you're going to host something like this, you can't host it without compromising Islam, unfortunately. The fans want alcohol. They want to experience that drunken state when they're enjoying themselves. They want to have rowdy behavior. That's what it's all about. If you look at the way they entertain themselves is part of the culture of a non-Muslim. And if you're going to try and mix that with Dawah, that's fine, good luck with that. But of course, they've